you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Let's change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello and welcome to another Nonprofit Snapcast. I have an old friend on the line with me, Mark Cattle. Mark is the innovation, Mark is an innovation director of blockchain and DeFi and NFTs. I'm sure I'm screwing that up, Mark. How did I get it wrong?
No, you're fine. You're fine.
So who are you working with now?
Working with Baseline Protocol, which is actually an implementation of blockchain, which is really where the evolution has taken the technology, in its current form, circa right now in early December 2021, expected to change, pretty much month to month going on. It's gotten a lot of traction right now, a lot of visibility and a lot of popularity right now.
So I guess I kind of want to start from the beginning. You know, we're talking about cryptocurrencies. We're talking about blockchain. Can we do crypto 101 real quick and talk about what blockchain means to crypto and vice versa?
Yeah, and it's a very common question that we get all the time. And it's really funny because blockchain as a concept is a little bit more complex as a technology than it would be for, you know, other types of software. Blockchain is really at its heart an ecosystem which functions well when you have multiple actors within a multi-party interactive environment that all need to have the same updated copy of the data, whatever they're going to be working with. And so, really it's important to give the distinction between cryptocurrencies and blockchain. I commonly tell people, cryptocurrencies are blockchain, but blockchain is not cryptocurrencies. Blockchain as a technology is the foundation layer or the plumbing, what makes it all possible. And the strength of blockchain lies in its distributed architecture, which brings immutability, tamper resistance, and distributed architecture. So anytime someone within the blockchain ecosystem makes a change to their data, that data is immediately promulgated across all of the other actors within the process environment.
So I've got to raise my hand here for a quick question.
Sure.
I'm thinking of my audience, and I know the question is going to be, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about strings of numbers? Are we talking about algorithms? What exactly is blockchain? Is it, how does it exist? Can I create one? Those are probably the questions that are going to, yeah.
Well, if you had the requisite knowledge and you had all of the back-end resources, you could actually break one. There's blockchain is offered by several different solution providers out there as a service to where just, they will do the setup, hosting, and administration of your blockchain solution set. But how blockchain works is really where you have, it stores data as transactions. And these are transactions that don't necessarily change value or change state, between movement, between different parties. But everything is stored as transaction, and it is put into what's called a block. And that block contains all of the transactions within it, as well as a unique fingerprint of that particular block. And that fingerprint, part of it, references the block immediately preceding it. And so if there is a transaction that does not follow a set path, it is not included. It's rejected by the blockchain. So, and that's really where we get back to the name, to where these are blocks that are put together, and it is a chain of blocks. And each of these blocks represent a particular capture moment in time. And that's really how the architecture works. Now, how blocks are made is what's gotten a lot of attention recently, is through a method called mining. And this is within the Bitcoin blockchain. And there are others that use mining. And that is based on a consensus mechanism that's called proof of work. And what you need to do to be able to commit a new block, sign and commit a new block to the network, you have to solve a very complex mathematical puzzle, something that, you know, far outstrips the human brain, really, to do so in a timely fashion. You know, it takes a lot of brute force computational power to actually come in, solve that puzzle. And if you, the first one solving the puzzle gets the privilege of actually signing and committing the new block to the chain. And in doing so, they are given a block reward, which right now is at about 7.5 Bitcoin, or depending on particularly whichever network you're working on. You are paid in either cryptocurrency fees, or you are paid in with additional what we call tokens, which can be exchanged for value. But the tokens actually are very useful because they allow you this additional capability, and we'll get into tokenization in just a minute. So, but you know, all of this brute force computational power comes, you know, requires a lot of electricity. Because of just the energy expenditure, many blockchains are moving to a different consensus mechanism that is not going to use as much power.
You use the term consensus mechanism. Who is making the consensus?
Consensus, you have within a blockchain environment, you have all the people that are writing and reading the different data, and you need to be able to know that data is trustworthy, has not been tampered with, and is shared with everyone else on there. And you have within the blockchain architecture what's called a consensus algorithm, and you have to have a certain number of nodes. And a node is any particular position on a blockchain that has read and write access. They can actually read it, and then they can also contribute their own, which is then going to be updated in the next block. So, you know, it's one of those, it's excellent for process environments to where you don't have to trust or even know your counterparty to know that data is the same for you as it is for them. And so within the blockchain architecture, you're going to have certain nodes that will then agree on the consistency of the data, making sure that it is correct, complete, and comes from a trusted source. And you always have, you have what's called validator nodes, and that is what gets the consensus amongst the validator nodes that this data is in effect genuine. And so that's when we talk about consensus. And it happens, it's completely non-human interact. It is done completely, through a technological and cryptographical standpoint. You have many different flavors of consensus mechanisms. Probably a famous one is what they call the Byzantine fault tolerance, the Byzantine generals. And that goes back to what cryptographers call the Byzantine generals problem. And it goes back to, a historical story to where there was the Byzantine army was besieging a small town or city state, and you have one general that's in charge of all of the forces, and they will have other generals that are subordinate. And how do they know that the generals are telling them the correct intelligence, what is up to date? Because this goes back to, this is an ancient situation here, and or an ancient setting. And so you don't have that immediate communication. And so that's what they call the Byzantine generals problem, is how can you tell, even if, one or more nodes have decided to go rogue and say, we want to try and do something different, it ultimately will not commit to the block because it has not solved the Byzantine generals problem. And so that's really how it actually works out. So
got it. So Bitcoin actually solves the problem.
Yes. And Bitcoin is the first implementation of blockchain. And how that came out was in 2008, on the heels of the global financial crisis, many people really did not trust the banking system, you know, because, you know, you would have too many instances of where you would have bankers that would have their fingers on the scales, you know, between a buyer and a seller. You had to have that neutral third party that would validate and close the transaction, which was often, you know, a central bank or a nation state that would give the blessing of that, and, you know, the whatever interaction could then go ahead and proceed. And so that's when we had a an enterprising party, I would say, person that named Satoshi Nakamoto. And he launched the Bitcoin white paper in 2008. Now, Satoshi Nakamoto has not been identified to a person, and they actually seem to think that it may be more than one person. But it's that one, we don't know who he is. And so, you know, some people have an idea, but, you know, the fact that Satoshi, to be kind of, you know, mysterious, actually has a certain amount of value that they don't want to get rid of. So, but at the time, this is a way that you could have a medium of exchange between two people anywhere in the world, and they would not require, you know, validation or settlement by a third party for an exchange. So they introduced the concept of a digital, you know, a cryptocurrency. Basically, it is a medium of exchange that is shared amongst everybody on the network. Everyone knows exactly what supply there is, what the value of each particular Bitcoin is, and it is universally understood and accepted. And the provenance, you know, the transaction history is, you know, immutable and, you know, free for anyone to view on there. So there's no incentive to try and get around it. And so that's really how cryptocurrency started. Started getting traction was because people found it particularly attractive that you could, you know, consume and, you know, pay for goods and services without using a, you know, a fiat currency that is bound to whatever, you know, nation that issues it, or a bank to actually sit and settle and close a transaction. They want to be able to say, you know, I can basically go ahead and, you know, exchange with people without, you know, the bank or the government even knowing about it. It really started to gain a lot of traction around 2014, 2015, you know, as a true medium of exchange. But at the same time, they were starting to look at, well, there's a foundation layer that makes all of this happen. This can be useful in any type of multi-party process environment to where people need to know and have complete data. And, you know, and there are different ways that it can be shared that you do not have to reveal any of that data. And, it, you know, which is very attractive for people that, you know, either in a, you know, very competitive industry and they don't want any type of breadcrumbs being dropped where they can maybe divine some intelligence about, you know, one of their competitors or counterparties that they participate with in a blockchain ecosystem. If they could, you know, see, you know, maybe divine some inference, some competitive advantage out of that. So that's really what I started working in was within the enterprise space. And, you know, a lot of people were using blockchain really as a fancy database or, you know, or even a replacement for an ERP system. You know, this is a way that you could do the transformation. Everybody within the organization had the complete updated copy of all of the data. Well, in practice, that's a little bit different. One thing you find out, people don't really want that much transparency. You know, they're like, you know, there's some people that we don't need to know. You know, we don't want to let anybody, you know, on the shop floor, you know, start talking about, you know, what might the people on the in the C-suite be doing. And second of all, you know, blockchain, you know, in that particular use case could not demonstrate that it could outperform the current environment and do so cost effectively. And so, you know, and many large tech companies invested very heavily in blockchain with this particular, you know, implementation. and really could not get the adoption, and they're scratching their heads as to why. And, you know, for two reasons. Number one, the implementation, you know, contemplates that it's going to be displacing a certain part of the IT architecture. You're going to rip and replace something. And given what blockchain has its strengths for, it's going to wind up ripping and replacing an ERP system. And then realistically, ERP systems are multi-million dollar, you know, solution sets that go through very painful implementations. And they're on multi-year amortization schedules. And it's just not going to be practical that you're going to bring in a new nascent technology to actually upgrade this. First of all, because a CIO wants to remain employed. Second of all, they don't want to actually have to, you know, completely rearrange the furniture within their architecture because, you know, the admins of that, the IT admins generally have it working the way they want it to by now. So, but at the same time, you know, blockchain offers a lot more value in, you know, other ways of actually implementing it, particularly when you start using it as middleware. And, you know, when you move it away from a single source of truth to at least have a proof of consistency. And this is one of the, you know, biggest emerging use cases, you know, utilizing blockchain technology right now is, you know, a multi-party workflow environment to whether you have a supply chain that can have anywhere from, you know, three to, you know, hundreds of actors within it, or, you know, even just people that, you know, are buyers and sellers of critical components, and they don't want to, you know, have to reveal any more data than they want to just because of either data privacy compliance or because they don't want to give away their competitive position. So, and if you look at, you know, industries that are ripe for that type of application, the first one that comes to mind is healthcare. You know, healthcare is, you know, within the USA is $13 trillion marketplace. And it is so enormous and it is so fragmented and so non-interoperable that, you know, any solution is going to take a lot of faith and a lot of hope and a lot of patience to even move the needle, you know, one spot.
Yep.
So if you were to do it, and that's the case, if you were to try and, you know, realign the entire architecture, what this new technique calls, and we call it baseline protocol, that you can baseline your data sets, all of the data that you have in your system of record, you can prove consistency within your counterparty system of record. So I want to make sure that my invoice matches your bill. And so, and in an industry that's really ripe for this, healthcare, if you look at adjudicating a healthcare claim, it can take anywhere from 60 to 90 days. And all of that is basically trying to align up all of the different counterparties, you know, to where they can then pay, settle, and close the claim. You know, within baseline, you know, using the process environment there, nobody has to share any data. So you are not going to run afoul of the data privacy requirements. And you then have the confidence that, you know, your record keeping matches that of your counterparty, and it is proven through what we call zero knowledge. And you know, and it's the only way that it actually works, is that I can basically prove to you that my data set matches yours without having to reveal anything about it. And so using baseline, if you look at it in a healthcare setting, it takes the cycle time, it virtually eliminates the back office reconciliation. It takes the cycle times, you know, from, you know, weeks or months to minutes or seconds. So, but if you look at, you know, different, that's just an example of, you know, the evolution of how blockchain is being used as, yep, you know, away from it being a dominant component of the IT architecture, you know, and basically giving your process environment, you know, that, you know, markedly improved level of confidence. And you have a universal state of synchronization that is easy to maintain. And again, if you were interested in implementing a process environment such as this, you could do it without a significant capital investment. You're using your existing systems already.
Right.
All you're doing is you are adding an additional capability, proving that they are consistent with everybody else that you need your data consistent with. You know, another thing that has come out, particularly within the past 12 months, is tokenization, or what they call NFTs. And NFTs, you know, have gotten a lot of buzzword right now, and they, people are like, "What's an NFT?"
I've actually heard that they might be falling out of favor for some reason. I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, here's the thing: when it comes to NFTs, is a lot of people are like, "NFT, what is that?" And you're like, "Non-fungible token."
Right.
And of course, they're like, "What?"
Yeah. Huh? Yeah.
Fungible.
Yep.
Fungible means basically that it is, can be exchanged for value, and its value is consistent, no matter what it is. You know, a Bitcoin is going to be worth a Bitcoin no matter where it is. Non-fungible are things to where they are unique and they are authentic. And so by tokenizing is what it's called, a token. And the concept of a token, has been around forever. If you use a movie ticket, that is a token that gives you access to the theater. Right. And basically it represents it's a digital representation of a physical object or service. So those, using blockchain, because, blockchain will give you that permanence and that singularity. Because no one could ever get away with trying to counterfeit it, clone it, change it to something else and try and pitch it as a genuine article, because they would be found out almost immediately just by a simple query of the blockchain network. That would give it a thumbs up or down. Probably an easy illustration within a real world use case would be, say, invoice financing. Or factoring, as they would call within the banking industry. And it's been around for over a century. The garment industry really, was a big practitioner of it and still is. But what that is, if you are a manufacturer of a particular good or service, you incur costs in manufacturing it. And you only recover those costs once that item is sold. And, within the garment industry, because there are seasonal fashion, movements and stuff, what you're spending to make in April, you may not get compensated for until, the fall, until September. They would use what was called factoring, to where we have sold and delivered goods, and we now have an invoice that we are promised to pay. We need money today. We can't wait for 30 or 60 days based on the terms of this invoice to wait for that. So they would then go to a financing company, a factor, that would then say, we will give you 90 cents on the dollar for this invoice today. And then when the invoice is paid, they pay us instead of you. And it's been around for a long time. Problem that you run into that within that industry is making sure that if you're buying an invoice, that you are buying the only authentic golden copy of that invoice. Because it is a persistent problem that, people who are desperate for, working capital may sell that invoice two or three times. And the invoice is only going to be paid once. And so that, bumps the risk profile considerably. With tokenization, you can take that invoice and you can tokenize it. And the record of that token is stored on a blockchain. So you know that it is singular. And it's not going anywhere. And so this is a way that you can increase, completely reduce the, almost eliminate the risk profile on this. And the the system or the process of invoice factoring can work the way that it's designed to. But at the same time, you can actually start scaling this up into, a method of trade. And there's a company out of California that is tokenizing these collectible, very expensive bottles of wine. And most of the people that, buy and sell these, they don't drink it. They sell it because they want to sell it to someone who will pay them more money than what they paid for it.
Right.
you know, what economists would call the greater fool theory. Who is the greater fool here?
Right.
So, but at the same time, you sit there and you look at it and say, you know, instead of having to, you know, deal with just receipts or certificates that you own this, this is even better because it can't be tampered with and it can't be duplicated. And so you have the confidence, and that's going to preserve the value of whatever bottle of wine or anything, really, anything that can be expressed as a number can be tokenized. So.
Interesting. Okay. So we're rapidly running out of time, and I love the conversation, but I need to reel us in a little bit. You know, I'm sure that if you're a nonprofit, especially like even a medium to a small size nonprofit, there's got to be a little bit of trepidation on how to break into crypto, how to use it. Should they be taking donations in crypto? And if they should be, how do they do that? I know that there are a lot of third party solutions for that sort of thing, but let's bring it down to brass tacks from a very practical standpoint and figure out how to tell a small to medium sized nonprofit whether or not they should be playing in the field and how they can safely do that.
Well, I mean, and I would say certainly, you know, that there's absolutely no danger or risk involved in accepting crypto as donations. And in fact, I would think that would be something that would be quite attractive because there has been such a run up in the value of so many cryptocurrencies right now. People are going to need to offset, you know, a lot of these gains, you know, for tax purposes. And, you know, the best, you know, my favorite way of doing that is to donate, you know, that to someone who can actually use that value and use that wealth for, you know, greater purposes.
Yep.
And, you know, crypto is not particularly exotic anymore. I mean, any professional money manager, whether it's Fidelity or JP Morgan, Charles Schwab, all of them now have invested to where they can actually act as agents and custodians for crypto. Because crypto has, again, it's immutable. There's not anything that can be hacked or disauthenticated or anything like that. You know, it's basically become another asset class. And, you know, if someone says, here, I want to, you know, I've made a lot of money in Bitcoin. I'm going to really get bitten by the IRS and stuff. And so I want to minimize my tax bill and I want to donate. And so a way of doing that is, you know, just tell me who is your investment advisor, who's actually handling the back thing. You know, most of the time they are going to be set up to receive crypto. Mm-hmm. And you can either keep it in native, you know, I mean, keep it as Bitcoin, or if you need to, go ahead and convert it to fiat currency, to the dollar. And if there's another example where, you know, Bitcoin or cryptocurrency themselves, you know, are certainly volatile, there's a way that you can convert it into what's called a stable coin. And a stable coin is a cryptocurrency that is pegged one-to-one to a fiat currency.
Right.
And so that way it's going to whatever the dollar is that day, or the yen or the euro, you know, is going to remain constant. It is pegged one-to-one. And that's done through large liquidity pools that are generally over-collateralized.
I see.
For this, just so that you have the you have the confidence in it. So, I mean, now as far as, you know, nonprofits, and if they want to, and they are, you know, certainly, you know, want to take a little bit of a leap, I would say definitely art museums. You know, if you want to certainly tokenize, you know, individual pieces of art from the artist. You know, the artist can basically profit from the, you know, tokenization of that. And they can also get a recurring income stream that every time that that token is then bought and sold downstream, they then get some revenue from that as well. So that is one way, but that is going to take, you know, really a well thought out way of putting it. But you will have heard of this. If you haven't already, you will hear about this within the next within the next year, as far as
it's imminent, I think within the next few months, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
And the big thing is, and now you've got a lot of bankers that are really staying awake at night because they're going, these people are able to exchange without us. They don't need us for anything, no matter how large the transfer is. I mean, if you are a company and you need to transfer, $1 million, cross border, I wouldn't say $1 million. I'd say if you had to do a large redemption of, say, $200 million, really, the current banking system is not set up to do that in one transaction. It has to be done batch through there just because of how the plumbing works within the banking system.
Yep.
With SWIFT network and the different payment rails. This is a way that, it's exchanged. I mean, nobody needs to bless it, or, if you want to look for something like, where is that neutral third party that ultimately gives the confidence? That's the blockchain.
So who should a nonprofit call on for help getting set up in this way? Are we talking about, are there third-party consultants that do this kind of work for nonprofits? Are there simple firms that they could sign on with? Is it whoever handles their 401k setup? Who does that?
Well, I would say whoever does their banking is going to be the first place that I would go. And it's not, like I alluded to before, crypto is mainstream now. Mm-hmm. Every major payment, unless you're dealing with a small community bank, in a rural, less populated state that, just has not had the need to upgrade to that. But any large bank already has set up and are comfortable with handling crypto.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those where a lot of people, kind of sit there and they're a little bit, have the trepidation because they don't know what they don't know.
Right.
And, I sit there and tell them, and I said, when it comes to, these new asset classes, treat them similar as you would any other type of, commodity or, equity or even debt for bonds and stuff. Crypto is just another different asset class.
That's exactly right. That is absolutely exactly right. Mark, you've clearly got a lot to say on the topic. I'm beginning to think maybe you should write a book or the primer on crypto, especially for the nonprofit world. I think that would be good if you could break it down and give them crypto 101 or blockchain 101. I think that would be a really cool thing for you to do. And if you're looking for a co-author, let me know.
definitely. And the thing is, you can find, online decentralized publishers that can basically put out. You wouldn't necessarily need a, Random House or, Doubleday Publishing to actually go out there and promote the book.
That's
you
right.
can actually go ahead, set up a website, say, this is our book, and, put all of the great platitudes about it and everything, get some reader testimonials.
And absolutely. All that
other stuff, and launch it yourself.
And that's launch, exactly.
And that's the big thing is all this is it opens up so many more possibilities because this allows you to, engage into a community that has the confidence that they can trust whatever you're contributing to it,
right.
Whether it's data, whether it's ideas or anything. And it is, immutable. It is etched in stone. Having that, is attractive.
If a listener wanted to learn more about crypto, or if they wanted to ask you questions about it, how would you suggest they get in contact with you, or where can they go to learn more?
I would say, two different ways. Number one, I'm certainly available anywhere. You can reach out to me on, I've got a LinkedIn profile, probably would be an easy way of doing it. Another one is to look at Baseline Protocol. That's baseline-protocol.org. And we are in the middle of a, after about a year and a half of solid work, we have our stable releases ready to come out. It's just, right now, you don't want to do a new product in the middle of December. Everybody's either, trying to finish up everything from the year, or they're in holiday parties and all this. And, if you give them all of the, the release and stuff, and they say, hey, call us on January 6th, January 6th, is a world away.
Right.
And when you're on January 6th, your product announcement was a world away.
Right.
So that's in the middle of putting it out, but we do have several providers, and actually we do have our launch customer, which is a very large soft drink bottler that has an enormous supply chain. That was looking at they were trying to use a blockchain solution for this. and really could not get it to scale to the level that they needed. You know, because, you know, blockchain, when you start to have a lot of actors in there, it starts to kind of slow a little bit. And it's imperceptible to the human, you know, brain. But when you start to look at, different types of throughput methods, as they would say, it'll slow down a little bit. That's really where you start to kind of get into the scaling thing, because you have all this data replication. Whenever I, add a comma or, erase a period at the end of the sentence, that's promulgated to everybody.
Right. Good stuff. Fascinating stuff. And I'm sure we could talk about this for days on end. But we do have to wrap up the episode. And I'm going to thank my listeners for hanging in there with us today. There's a lot more to learn about from crypto. If you have any questions about getting your nonprofit involved in cryptocurrency, whether, trading in it or accepting donations at a minimum, please send me your questions at the website, nonprofitsnapcast.org. I'll make sure we get those questions answered. And in the meantime, Mark, thank you so much for being my guest today. I know you're very busy, but I really enjoy connecting with you again after so many years. And I think that the subject matter is simply fascinating. So thank you.
It really is. And I would say, just on one parting note, I would say to, everybody within the nonprofit space that may have some trepidation regarding crypto, don't be. It has come such a long way in the awareness and the mainstream adoption of it. It's really just another asset class today.
That's right. Very cool. Thanks, Mark.
This has been The Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.
The Snapcast is a production of the Nonprofit Snapshot. Please visit us at nonprofitsnapshot.org to learn more about our consulting work and the ways we can help your organization continue to make the world a better place.